Thanks very much, Steph. Okay, folks, here goes. So the title is Untangling the Tangle. I hope people can hear me. If you really can't hear me, maybe wave and I'll do my best. So the titles come from a Buddhist teaching. It's like one of from the Samyutta Nikaya. And I thought that the title was really catchy. That's part of also what caught my eye when they were like, oh, you know, got invited to say something. You have to sort of say what you're going to do ahead of time. It's not always clear what you're going to do. So anyway, that's where the title has come from. But I really do enjoy going back and looking at some of the stories. So Untangling the Tangle has come from a conversation. So back in the day, some 2,500 years ago, people would go to the Buddha and ask him questions. Lovely. I'll carry on. So they would go to the Buddha and ask him questions. So basically this guy goes to the Buddha and he says, a tangle inside, a tangle outside. This generation is entangled in a tangle. I ask you, O Gotama, one of the names of the Buddha, who can disentangle this tangle? And I don't know, there's something about that that seems relevant. 2,500 years seems super relevant now and very, very relevant to my own life. So I don't know what the word tangle or not sort of evokes for you, but I remember when I came across one of the reasons why I asked for ordination in particular was I felt in quite a tangle. So I was trying to think a bit what that was about, and it's very hard to sort of pray these things into one line, but I think there was almost like two momentums going on at the time that weren't working particularly well for me. And one of them was like, try as hard as you can, and the other one was like, give up. So it would be like, what would happen is I'd like hurl myself almost literally at things. Do you know what I mean? Like dive in and then somehow sort of hit something and then just be like, oh, I can't really do this. And it was sort of reinforced. So there was some sort of pattern like that. So anyway, that was one of the reasons why I decided to ask for ordination. But just prior to coming, so I went to the Colchester Buddhist Centre, that's where I found the Dharma. Just prior to coming there, I'd sort of had a bit of an epiphany moment, and I'm sure, I imagine all of you can sort of relate to that. It was a sort of a moment where time stood still almost. And it was a bit like I was out of my usual sort of mind, so we can kind of call it small mind, you know. Out of some sort of constriction, and there was just this sort of complete openness, and I just felt this complete connection. I know it's a bit cliche to say like complete love for all beings, but it did feel like that. So it's almost like I had that sense. There was somewhere I was trying to get to. I sort of knew this, bust, whatever, didn't quite work, and I'd had experiences of sort of other, mind-opening moments, generally under other substances, but I knew there was another way, but I didn't quite know how to get there, if you see what I mean. So anyway, having described that moment of unentanglement, of sort of like consciousness unfolding in a certain way, that has not been my abiding experience. And that might be the same for you, I don't know. So here we are back at the tangle. So it's a bit like, you know, consciousness expands and then sometimes this contraction continues. So what is this tangle? You might be curious. So Buddhaghosa, an Indian Buddhist scholar, describes this sort of tangle, this entanglement, this ensnarement, almost as a net of craving. So I know that sounds a bit like, but it's a bit like that, isn't it? So based on sort of pleasant experience, so people sort of smiling and seeming interested, you know, I sort of want to continue to evoke that response. I want to try harder. And based maybe on people slightly falling asleep or getting tired, which is natural at a festival, I'll probably think, oh, I'm becoming very boring and may this end now. So it's a bit like that. We're sort of, this pushes and pulls are going on all the time. So I wanted to share a bit of a personal, embarrassing example of that sort of inner and outer entanglement. And I sort of wanted to be like, oh, that was years ago. But actually, it was like under 3 weeks. And it's quite embarrassing. Anyway. So, yeah. Anyway. That's how it is. So, if any of you have been on retreat, you might have a sense that the kitchen is quite a melting pot. Do you know what I mean? A lot goes on in the kitchen. I know the catchphrase, you know, the heat, if you can't handle the heat or whatever, I can't remember it now. Don't get into the kitchen. Anyway, I got into the kitchen. I shouldn't have been there. Anyway, so a few of us were going to be, cooking the food. We were running late, basically. We were running late, and the meal needed to happen. It needed to happen at a certain time. Retreat's going on. You know, it's a well-oiled machine's happening. So what happened was I was like, right, I'm going to do this. And then someone decided they were going to help me, but they were a lot quicker than I was. You know, like, boom, boom, boom. I was a bit like, oh. And then someone decided that they were going to oversee it. So basically tell me a bit what to do. Anyway, that might not have been what was happening. That was my experience. So all of a sudden, I just felt in this squeeze. It was a bit like both. Do you know what I mean? From both sides, I just felt this kind of like tight constriction come in. And it was a bit out of, felt a bit like out of nowhere. It wasn't out of nowhere, but anyway, felt a bit out of nowhere. I just got caught in this storyline of I can't do this. I just can't do this. And the storyline just got so big. I was like trying to measure the salt out. Someone has a salt. I was like, oh my God, like, is this 1 teaspoon? I just like, anyway, that's the state that I sort of got to. And I just sort of thought, I've got to leave. Like, I just can't do it. And I can't remember, actually, a saving grace, the last time that happened. But anyway, this world sort of opened up and I just thought, oh, I've just got to leave. So in the midst of this, I was like, I'm sorry, I've got to leave. And I think everyone's quite shocked. But anyway, I had to leave. I had to get out. So when I was thinking a bit around this tangle, these tangles can be very messy, you know. So anyway, that felt pretty messy. And what it felt like, it was a bit like there was a huge relief in leaving, actually. But that didn't last long because I thought, oh, my God, I'm going to have to go back. So anyway. So when I was thinking about whether I wanted to share this or not, and actually there was a part of me that did not want to share this, but anyway, I was thinking, will I, won't I? What came to mind a bit was the film Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. So I just need to get a bit of a sense of, has anyone seen that film? Okay, good, good. Anyway, it seems like quite a lot of people haven't seen it. Anyway, you're missing out. So basically, anyway, the film came to mind, but I just give a little thing. So the film is set, I'm going to do this really badly now, somewhere in America, I think New York, 1920s maybe, looking at Bayonara. Yep, lovely. And basically this guy has got a suitcase full of these fantastic beasts, yeah? So, and they escape, and some of the film is recapturing these beasts. So, the reason why that came to mind is that there was one particular fantastic beast in that film called, I'm probably not going to pronounce the name right, Okami? Okami? Ring a bell? Anyway, people are nodding. And it's a bit of a cross between a serpent and a bird. So if you let your imagination go, it's this, like, creature. And what's really interesting about it is that the creature takes the size of the habitat that it's in. So, like, if it's in a tiny space, it's tiny. If it's in a big space, it's big. So in this film, this huge creature was in attic somewhere. I'm ad-libbing, I don't know. I should have watched it again, but anyway. And the roof was starting to cave. The building was starting to cave in. So when I was reflecting a bit on this tangle that I got in, which I'll say a bit more about, it felt about in that moment, it was a bit like this inner child of like 3 or 5 sort of came in, and it just filled the whole picture. And I thought that was a really good example of that. And then in the film, there's a scene where in order to capture it, they throw this something to eat into this little teapot, and then it's almost like, you know, another world comes into being, something else is restored. So what really struck me a bit about that film that probably hardly anyone has seen was that these characters are sort of like embodiments of almost this push and pull, these very, very basic desires. They sort of take a form And you can see in the film the chaos that ensues as a result of it, really. And when I was thinking about these different tangles and how almost worlds come into being, which hopefully I'll make a bit clearer. So in that moment in the kitchen, all that was actually going on was I was making dinner with people who were anxious. And we were anxious because we were running out of time. That's all, in a way, what was really going on. But what happened was from this sort of like increased alienation inward, outward became very, so other people felt very, very solid and very, very other. Do you see what I mean? They didn't feel like there was a way of dialogue. So all of a sudden the world became a bit unsafe in that moment. So Sangharakshita, the founder of Tri Ratna community, Buddhist community, says we're a bundle of conflicting desires, even conflicting selves, loosely tied together with a name and address. And it felt a little bit like that, you know. So hopefully I've given it a bit of a flavour of this entanglement that we can get into, and hopefully it might involve, you know, you might have something going on for yourself now, something that the mind keeps circling round to. What I also noticed in this film, no one's seen, is that the hero was in a real relationship to these beasts, actually really, really cared about them, and some of them weren't very good looking. Do you know what I mean? Yet there just seemed to be this a natural way of relating with care. So I think Dana Raja in his talk yesterday was sort of talking about this turning towards. So it's a bit like the process of disentangling means turning towards and intimately sort of getting to know these different parts, you know, these different beasts in a way, if you like that analogy, or different selves that sort of emerge in the moment. And this turning towards, just makes a really big difference. So I was thinking, what has sort of really helped me in this turning towards process has been the Metta Bhavana practice. So I don't know how many people here don't know what the Metta Bhavana practice is. If you want to just fearlessly put your hands up. Okay, so that's really helpful. So the Metta Bhavana practice is one of two meditations that we tend to do at classes, and it's the one I think I first came across when I came to the Colchester Buddhist Centre. And it's got five stages to it. So first you sort of turn towards yourself, you bring yourself to mind, and you sort of wish yourself well, and then it goes out to a good friend, then someone you don't really know, then someone you don't really get on with or you've got some sort of difficulty with, and then you sort of widen it out to include everyone. And what I found really, really helpful about that metta practice is that over time, in a way, it just helped me to bear with more unpleasant emotions. So it's a bit like when I would sit to meditate, actually different sides would come up, would emerge. So this whole like chuck everything at it, chuck yourself at it, would come from a huge sort of sense of lack. You know, so in order to be a bit more appropriate or to be more okay with others, I just need to just give it as much as I could. And then the whole bust, you know, like, right, that's it, I'm out, which is a bit what happened in the kitchen, I'm out of here. You know, they're quite hard sort of momentums to sit with, but there's something about the metta practice that over time made that easier. It was a bit like, actually, I could still sort of learn to turn towards, but without being so caught up in it needing to be a pleasant experience. It's a bit like I got to learn that actually it was still okay, even if it wasn't a particularly positive or pleasant experience. So, because the, you know, the habitual response is a bit like unpleasant experience, push away, pleasant experience, want more of. But actually, if we want to integrate and make progress, it's a bit like we've got to take all of those sides a bit with us. So I think in a way, I'd sort of say that metta practice really changed my life. And some of it, one of the things is it also sort of triggers a lot of those responses. So if you've got a complex relationship with yourself, which I had, sort of bordering on a lot of sort of self-hatred, then actually it's very, very painful to be there. But then you bring a good friend to mind and you're like, if you've not had an argument with them, boom, you know, you're in the zone and, you know, you're feeling it a little bit more. Then you bring, you know, a neutral person to mind and you're a bit like, oh, this is a bit boring. And, you know, because there's not enough of a frisson or whatever. And then you bring a difficult person to mind and you're like, oh my God, why are they like that? You know, so it's just, it sort of triggers a bit some of those, you know, sort of like, anyway, that's what would sort of go on for me a bit. You know, so it's in a, yeah, anyway, I sort of wanted to share that because it has, yeah, it's made a really, really big difference to me. And also it sort of really helped me sort of realise I can be in relationship without it needing to be pleasant all the time, you know. That, you know. Anyway, so I've got a quote from Ram Dass, and he says, through all the years of my practice, from psychotherapy, from meditation and yoga, I have never got rid of a single neurosis. There they still are. But they have gone from being huge, scary monsters to delightful little schmoozes. I see one coming along, and I say, oh, there you are again. Tricky little thing, aren't you? Anyway, I really, really like that. So the other reason why I also wanted to mention this film, Fantastic Beasts, was that what I saw clearly... Anyway, if you see this, and if it's nothing like this, just don't worry. But anyway, my sense of it was when I was thinking about it and thinking about tangling and disentangling was that how some of these beasts, these fantastic beasts, and what's very, very interesting to sort of say actually is, to my mind, the film was almost quite grey, but when the monsters were involved, it was a bit like there was colour, there was life. Yeah, anyway, that was my sense of that. But it's interesting that what I found in the film was that these beasts sort of pointed almost our habitual, almost instinctual, momentum or mind. This sort of like how we can just act out of habit when there isn't enough mindfulness there. So there's another really delightful creature called Nuffler. Nuffler, is that right? Snufflum. Anyway, who knows? But anyway, it's a little... None of you know. I could just say it was called Joe. You wouldn't know. Anyway, there was this... There's this like little creature, and it was black and furry, and it kept anything shiny it wanted to put in its stomach pouch. So the chaos that ensued of him going around and just making everything his, even when he couldn't walk. And anyway, so there's something kind of like quite instinctual almost. There's something about that that I could really relate to. You know, that sort of tangle can easily involve that fight or flight response, you know, just acting in a very habitual sort of way. This push and pull, and this push and pull, which is part of the tangle, this craving that I'm trying to talk about, this push and pull just sort of really sort of solidifies inner and outer self and other. And out of that sort of solidifying, a preoccupation with sort of focusing inwards, out of that solidifying, there's a real need to protect and defend, you know. So we can, when we start to turn towards, we can see a little bit more that when we get caught up in storylines, it's a bit like that wasn't the whole picture. So the kitchen example, it feels in that moment like that's the whole picture. I cannot tell you how many times I have made dal. I'm half Indian, you know, but in that moment, it was like someone was asking me to climb Mount Everest and I literally couldn't do it. So it's a bit like this world sort of opens up from inwardly, and this limited perspective comes in. And I was sort of really sort of thinking, oh yeah, that's the sort of habitual mind that's really looking to defend and protect. So that's all you see, what you think the threat is, rather than a bit the bigger picture. So we might all have a bit of this. So there's another Buddhist sutta that I couldn't remember because I don't have any Wi-Fi here. I couldn't quite look it up. But there's this analogy here where the Buddha sort of says there's all these different beasts like lion, tiger, and they're all roaming in different directions. But he sort of gives this image of if there's actually a post that they're attached to, they'll try and go as far as they can and then they'll just sort of settle down. So there's something about mindfulness allowing things, well, what is that image about? But there's something about the centrality of mindfulness, sort of like not losing our purpose. I think that's what I'm trying to say. Not sort of losing our purpose of what really is we're trying to do. But often when we sort of get a bit into flight and fight response, we know there's a bigger part to ourselves, but that gets completely covered over. Like, I know I can make dal, and actually if someone's being a bit bossy, I sort of know that I can go, like, I'm not coping. Do you know what I mean? But in that moment, that possibility just wasn't there. So there's something about this process of untangling. There's something about metta and turning towards that really allows us to take on board that our actions have consequences. Like, that also had a bit of a consequence for the team that I was cooking with, although they were incredibly kind about it. What else did I want to say about that? Sorry, I'm going to have a little pause. So trying to sort of catch a bit this instinctual mind that can be part of creating the tangle both inside and outside is really becoming aware of these grooves. So in a way, by really responding to that, going along with that inner child, I've sort of slightly deepened the grooves under those conditions. She might come out more fully. But reflecting on it, what I ended up really seeing is actually what happened. Actually, no, I'm not going to say that just yet. Hang on, sorry. I'm just going to have a bit of water. Sorry. Lovely. Okay. So where are we? Blimey, I've lost my pot. So we're talking about metta, pushing and pulling, bringing mindfulness in to the tangle. So, we're sort of trying to break the knot a little bit of based on how we feel, how things unfold. So, yeah. So, coming back to the kitchen example, I think it will become clear why that was really important to me. So, and why I'm going on and on about it, but there's a gap, really. So in Buddhist practice, so what we're trying to do is gather up the different parts of ourselves. So that's often known as a stage of integration. Through knowing a bit more these different parts of ourselves, we can sort of turn towards them with a bit of love and compassion. And there's something about that process of sort of realizing that suffering isn't just to do with us. That is part of what happens when our consciousness, when we go into small mind, when our consciousness contracts in a certain sort of way. But there is also a way out of that. So there are other yearnings that we have as well. So I'm going to give a little quote from Nick Cave. So Nick Cave talks about the secret life of a love song. So there's so much more to our experience than what goes on. So he says, we all experience within us an inexplicable longing, an unnamed and enigmatic yearning of the soul. And it is this feeling that lives in the realm of imagination and inspiration and is the breeding ground for the love song. This longing is the desire to be transported from darkness to light, to be touched by the hand, which is not of this world. The love song is never simply happy. It must embrace the potential for pain. These songs that speak of love without having within their lines an ache or a sigh are not love songs at all, but rather hate songs disguised as love songs and are not to be trusted. The love songs must resonate within the whispers of sorrow and the echoes of grief. The writer who refuses to explore the darker reaches of the heart will not be able to experience the wonder, the joy, the magic of love. So within the fabric of a love song, within its melody, its lyrics, one must sense an acknowledgement of its capacity for suffering. So one way of working with the tangle is getting to know ourselves, connecting a bit more deeply, and allowing those different parts in. And another way of working with it in the moment, which is not what I managed in the kitchen scenario, was also seeing that there is a gap between feeling and craving. There is a gap between sort of experiencing unpleasantness, because this, well, I'm talking about the tangle, so that's why it's focused a bit more on that. There is a gap between experiencing that and then sort of this pushing or pulling away motion. And that's a bit what we talk of the gap. So what is this gap? So there is an opportunity in a way to touch something a bit bigger than this almost instinctual mind. So when mindfulness is there, there's an opportunity in a way for something else to unfold. And even sort of after the event, we can try and look at that a little bit. So I wanted to share a different example, which was of another moment of feeling quite deeply entangled. And a loved one was really poorly at the time. And I was trying to give them a hand. But at the same time, I was sort of experiencing quite a lot of pain. And a lot of the pain, in a way, was as a result of not wanting them to suffer and not being able to accept what was going on at the same time. I hope someone's all right and not exploded. Yeah, so yeah, that's the gap. So just to share this example. So what was going on was someone was having a really hard time, and there was something that I just couldn't accept about it. I just had this strong sense of actually things should not be like this. It shouldn't be like this. And what I sort of realised as I was experiencing that, so that, you know, took a little bit of time of just thinking, I don't want things to be like this. Something happened in that moment of turning towards. So I don't know whether it was to do with doing the metta practice and just sort of developing a bit more of a capacity to sort of hold it. But what happened in that moment was I just sort of realised it wasn't personal. So often some of the entanglement that happens between self and other is it can feel very personal in that moment. You know, sometimes we rail against the world like it shouldn't be like that, as if there is something very personal going on. And in that moment, yeah, I guess consciousness opens in a completely different way. And it's not that there's nothing. There was just this deep sense of love and connection. So it's a bit like when we're able to turn towards dukkha without feeling that push and pull, that craving that goes on, I guess without reacting, that is the basis of compassion. So I guess the freedom that we're trying to move towards is what lies beyond self-clinging. So in a way, what lies beyond self-clinging, what lies beyond the narrow focus of this instinctual self of just needing to protect ourselves. So the Buddha pointed towards a deeper freedom. He sort of says, actually, if we're able to turn towards these tangles, if we're able to really look at them, if we turn towards them, we can come out into the freedom. This, it's called the vimukti of the unbiased. So the image of that is this complete sphere on this level plane. And the sphere isn't moving in any particular direction. So often what happens is we're pushed and pulled in different directions. That's also sometimes why we're quite tired. So it's happening on quite a, sometimes sort of almost unconscious level. And the Buddha sort of spoke about it as the desire to become bhava tanha. So there's continued momentum to become. Or the other way, where we just don't want to exist at all. So the craving to not become vibhava tanha. So these two things in a way are happening. But actually when we're able to turn towards, often with mindfulness and compassion, we can sort of come out into the unbiased. So the vimukti is called the unbiased. And it's unbiased. So when we act without agenda, when we're not driven by our sort of our own limited ways of seeing things, we can come out in a genuine space of love, really, a space of just really being able to respond. So there's not nothing. We don't come out into nothingness if we're sort of not being pushed or pulled. And, yeah, with practice, we can just have a bit more confidence in it. So what this untangling can look like, I talked a little bit about the tangle, what this untangling can look like is, you know, in the face of a tangle, in the face of a difficult emotion, unpleasant feeling, rather than sort of experiencing the push and pull, so independence upon feeling, rather than getting into craving, what could arise on the basis of practice is sort of a responsiveness to values, a responsiveness to connection. So in that example that I gave about someone, a really close person sort of suffering, in that moment of being able to surrender a bit to the small mind, surrender to like, how can things possibly be like this? I don't want them to be like this. In being able to sort of just slightly let go in that moment, I opened into a bigger love and sense of connection, which enabled me to just have the capacity to keep going with the difficult situation in a way. So on the basis of unpleasant Vedana, or on the basis of unpleasant feelings, there is this gap where we can open to something bigger. And that's not necessarily always completely pleasant, just to say. But often when our consciousness completely opens, there is a real freedom to it. So what else I wanted to say is that, we're not trying to eliminate parts of ourselves. I think that's a really important thing to say. But part of me being trying to become more untangled has been part of trying to just disarm and protect myself a little bit less from others. So the reason why I ended up really wanting to talk about this kitchen entanglement was because the Buddha's experience of awakening, what he saw that everything was change. He saw that everything was process. And he saw that things arise and passed away, but he also saw that that wasn't based on nothing, that wasn't based on chance. Whatever arises, arises in dependence on conditions, and whatever ceases, ceases because those conditions cease. So a bit what the kitchen example was, I'm going to use someone else's words and see if I can sort of help explain it as a complete untangling. So there's a quote from Andrew Olensky, who's a Buddhist scholar. And he says, what becomes clear when we really bring mindfulness to bear is that this grasping, this reaching out, is not something done by the self, but rather self is something created by grasping. The self is constructed each moment for the simple purpose of providing the one who likes or doesn't like, holds onto or pushes away what is unfolding in experience. So this grasping is a source of selfing. It comes out of the sequence of feeling, craving, and grasping. This is at the heart of what keeps us going round. So a bit, that is exactly what happened in the kitchen, although I couldn't be in the gap to sort of catch it. So what happened on the basis of unpleasant sensations, feeling a bit constricted, the storyline from the past went on, and in a way, I just got completely... the storyline became the complete picture. So the grasping was just getting dominated by the storyline. So the sequence of feeling and pushing away that experience. Sorry, I'm not doing this very well. My confidence has gone a little bit. So on the basis of feeling unpleasant Vedana, this craving arose, which was sort of pushing away the experience. And through wanting to push away the experience, there was getting caught in the storyline. So what happened was it mirrored a familiar experience from earlier on in my life. That's sort of what got hooked onto that experience in the present moment. So the grasping took place of really sort of buying into this two-year-old. And afterwards, when I was sort of just reflecting on the experience, I thought, oh, wow, this two-year-old was just born out of the experience of the kitchen. That two-year-old didn't have an inherent existence of its own. But when I acted from it, it was as if that was the whole picture. So I guess what I've been trying to say, and I'm going to be finishing, what I've been trying to say is that, that tangle is born out of just really getting sort of slightly caught up in this more instinctual mind of protecting, protecting and pushing away. So I hope we sort of have a bit of a sense of this tangle is born out of a desire in a way. This desire to push or pull away, but often our desire is set a bit low. So as Nick Cave in his song says, our longing, there's a bit of a deeper longing for wholeness, but our ways of sort of going about it often are a bit limited and result in us sort of just going around a very habitual way of relating, a habitual mode of being. So through looking a bit more closely, turning towards what's going on and bringing mindfulness to bear, we can start to open up this gap to see that things are a bit more fluid than we imagine them to be. Yes, in that moment, the two-year-old emerged, but actually something else could have emerged as well. And after, you know, talking about it, you know, another sort of momentum emerged. So it's out of these momentums, in a way, we construct a bit of a fixed sense of self. Yep. So I'm just going to let Bhante have the last word, if I can find it. So basically, cutting the tangle sort of points to what lies beyond the ego project. So the Buddha in the sutta says that when we really see that actions have consequences and we work on our states of mind through meditation, we can come out into a deeper vision, which is this untanglement. And it's a bit the love that arises and we ourselves aren't there. So I'm just going to end on that.